Season 5 of Taboo, the Stories of Caribbean Women, has been sponsored in part by Limitless Learning TT. Limitless Learning TT caters to students struggling with English and mathematics by providing virtual one-to-one tutoring sessions that are tailored and personalized to fit each student's individual needs. They work with students of all ages who reside in the United Kingdom, the United States of America, and the Caribbean. To set up your initial assessment or for more information, please visit www.limitlesslearningtt.com. It's still a little bit taboo for women, particularly Caribbean women, to share their personal experiences publicly. As the old folks would say, this is a no-no, you shouldn't be airing your dirty laundry in public. There is this notion that women should suffer silently, as this somehow makes us stronger. I want to end that narrative. This podcast, Taboo, the Stories of Caribbean Women, is all about Caribbean women speaking up, owning, embracing, and sharing their truth in the hopes that it may help other Caribbean women. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Taboo, the Stories of Caribbean Women. I am Kiara James, the creator and host of this podcast. As usual, I have a guest with me in the studio. I'm very excited. I'm always excited. I feel like I say this all the time. I'm very excited that she's here to share this story, which is definitely a little bit taboo for the Caribbean. So I'm going to let her introduce herself and tell us very, very briefly about what her story entails.
Hi, everyone. My name is Melanie. I am a 42-year-old Canadian-born, Trinidadian-bred, and I am a breast cancer thriver and single mother by choice.
Love it. Thank you so much, Melanie, for coming on today. So let's start off. What was childhood like? Because you said Canadian-born, Trinidad-bred. So tell us about that childhood-wise. What was that like?
So my dad came up in the 70s to study architecture, and my mom followed thereafter. And of course, in the 70s, it was easy peasy when it came to immigrating. And they worked and studied, had my brother and I, and my dad. His intention was to always come to Canada, get his degree, and get the out. So for several reasons, the biggest one being the weather. And of course, you know, he's a big family man, being away from family. Mm-hmm. So, they just packed up. I was maybe a few months old, not even a year old, and I was born in June, and I believe by October of the same year, they were out of Canada. came to Trinidad and grew up, went to, you know, primary school, secondary school at St. Joseph's Convent, up the hill in St. Joseph. And yeah, I think growing up, my parents were always open about the fact that they knew that we had this opportunity to live and study in Canada, and encouraged us to be open about going back to Canada. So doing CXC and doing A's, it was always the intention that I would study abroad. At that time, my preference was the US because I had more family in the U.S. than I did in Canada. Mm-hmm. All of my dad's siblings, they migrated to the U.S. and he was the only one who migrated to Canada. So when we kind of looked at the offerings in terms of scholarships from U.S. schools and what I would pay in terms of a domestic student, because I was a Canadian citizen in a Canadian university, it made more sense from a financial standpoint to go to Canada to study, because it was just less, like the out-of-pocket expense that they would have had to pay, even with scholarships for an American student, for American studies was still going to be more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the decision was made. So my childhood in Trinidad was, I guess, normal for the most part. You know, growing up with just one brother, my dad was self-employed. He is still a practicing architect to this day. My mom was a housewife, and she also worked with him for some periods of time. So, yeah, just normal.
Normal. So are you currently in Canada or Trinidad?
I'm currently in Canada. So I stayed here. I came up for university, attended the University of Waterloo, did that for 4 years. And I just stayed, got jobs, went back to school after a point to get my MBA, and just have been working and, you know, a little bit of studying in between ever since. And I'm still here.
All right. Well, you, when you introduced yourself, you said single mother by choice. So what do you mean by single mother by choice?
So that term essentially means a mother who has gone the untraditional route of conceiving and having a child. And, you know, of course, the traditional route would be you meet someone and, you know, a guy, and you guys do the do and you have your child. And single mother by choice means going the scientific / medical route, going to a fertility clinic, picking a sperm donor. Basically doing it on your own in terms of relying on medical means to conceive and have your child.
So when and why did you decide to go this route?
So it was a bit born out of necessity in a way. So I believe in 2016, my doctor discovered that there was a cyst on my right ovary. Mm. So I had surgery to remove the cyst, but unfortunately the cyst was so big that they had to remove my entire right ovary. So up until that point, I was, you know, thinking meet the guy, get married, have kids. That was, it was what I came from, right? So it was all I knew. Again, remember being bred in Trinidad, I came up, and if there was one critique I would say about the medical system here in Canada, it would be that throughout my 20s, there was no conversations when I would go to the doctor, and female doctors at that. There were no conversations about fertility, like what are your plans and do you have someone in your life? And of course there were conversations about contraception, but nothing about fertility and fertility preservation. And so when I had that surgery to remove my right ovary, I started thinking, okay, well, I have one ovary now. I obviously want to wait until Mr. Right. I want to go down to the traditional route of conceiving and having a family. How's that going to look if one day my left ovary conk out because it's been overworked? And yeah, what am I going to do at that point? So I'd known about fertility preservation, so egg freezing, embryo freezing, and started looking into that. I started researching the cost. There are fertility clinics, of course, here in Toronto. So looking into the costs and what that process entailed. And I had this really good conversation with a coworker of mine one day, and we sat down and I was telling her about my plans. And out of the blue, she said, "Why don't you become a single mother by choice?" And she said that because, you know, of course I mentioned the exorbitant cost. Like I think at that time it was at least $20,000 to freeze your eggs. And in my research, you know, I realized that it's not guaranteed.
Wait a minute, $20,000 Canadian dollars?
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Exactly. It's not guaranteed. And a lot of women, even if they undergo the process, there isn't that much research to back up what happens after the fact, like the thawing, because the technology is still relatively new. And some women who have undergone that, they have perhaps gone on to conceive or have kids the natural way. Mm-hmm. So they haven't gone back to actually thaw. And the few that have, you know, gone on to thaw their eggs, the success rates of having a viable egg after that thawing was very abysmally low. So I thought, you spend all this money to then be like coming out of all of this with little to no eggs. So when I had that conversation with a coworker and she said, you know, I voiced my concerns about the cost and the success rates. And she was like, why don't you become a single mother by choice? And my immediate reaction, not knowing fully what it meant, was, what the hell does that mean? And then she went on to further explain, you know, it's having a kid on your own, because, you know, even for couples, it's never a perfect time. No one has the right amount of resources, mm-hmm. financial or mm-hmm. not. It's never a perfect time. So I thought, okay, let me take this in. Let me go back. And, you know, she did mention in our conversation, there are Facebook groups. Why don't I invite you and just ask all the questions that you want and, you know, go from there. So I did exactly that. I went into those Facebook groups. I read everything. You know, I'm just all about research. So I try to consume as much as possible. I asked so many questions about women who've thawed their eggs and they've confirmed, you know, their own stories about, you know, going through the process and maybe having one egg at the end of thawing or having no eggs. Some have commented that it's better to actually freeze embryos instead of eggs, which would mean an additional step of then having a sperm donor. Mm-hmm. The embryos are more viable and a bit stronger after the thawing process. So there was that, another consideration. But the majority were like, hey, you don't know when Mr. Right is coming along. And there are some stories of women who have gone on to marry and, you know, talks with their husbands about having kids. And then they've changed their minds after the fact or been married before. And just all these different permutations, variations of women who have come to the decision that it's never a perfect timing. My circumstances aren't perhaps never going to be perfect. So why not just pull the trigger and do this now? So again, I took it in and I can't remember how long I was dwelling on it, for a while. And one major thing that came up was acceptance, family acceptance. That was a huge thing. Some women talked about being basically ostracized by their family because of this decision, whether they came from a strong religious background or not. Mm-hmm. For whatever reasons, their parents were like, no, you know, they don't want a grandchild and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And so that was a big thing for me, again, growing up in the Caribbean, never, ever hearing about anything about an SMC or, you know, of course, you've heard of single mothers, but at least for me, it's always been, well, as a result of the marriage breaking up or an early, you know, pregnancy, but never a single mother as a result of having a child, you know, going this route. And so I remember distinctly not even coming to full, I guess, 100% decision on the matter and saying, you know, well, let me broach the subject with my mom and see what her take is. So I called her up and I said, I prefaced it by saying, Mommy, I'm about 70% sure that this is a decision I need to make. And they knew about my surgery and everything like that. About this is a decision that I want to make because, you know, I only have the one ovary you know, the dating pool, you know, that situation is bleak at this point in time. I'm no spring chicken anymore. So, like, for all these reasons, I think I want to go this route, you know, becoming an SMC. And I explained to her what it meant. And my mom, I would always say this. My parents have always been pretty open. They were strict, but I would say balanced. And my mom said, you know what, Melanie? Honest to God, last night I had a dream that you adopted. And that to me meant that she was open, that she was open to the fact that I would possibly have a child. I mean, in her answer, it was a non-biological child, but the fact that is that she's open, right? And she's considered, you know, and she continued, she said, you know, I thought about, you know, you adopting, and, you know, I was like, oh, I wonder if Melanie ever thought about this. But I didn't want to, you know, have this conversation with you because I know how you are. Because, again, I'm the type of person where it's just, especially in my adult life, I've always been very opinionated, and to my parents that translated many times being rude, but I've always stood firm in many of my decisions, to the point where sometimes my parents, they always say they take the stance where they would wait for me to approach certain things. So that was a conversation that I had with my mom. And at the end of it, I was like, okay, yeah, I know that's not going to be an obstacle.
Yeah.
And even if they objected to it, I would have still gone on with the decision. But of course, it would have made the journey much harder. Yeah. I probably had to have started therapy earlier. Right? So, yeah, so I was really, really glad that I didn't have that to deal with. And from that point on, it was just go, go, go. You know, I made the appointment with the fertility clinic, and they have requirements. Back then, when I did it, the first thing was getting an appointment with a psychiatrist because they want to make sure that you're mentally stable.
Yeah.
That this is a decision that you're fully aware of what the consequences are, the ramifications. And so I did that, as well as, of course, from a medical standpoint, you had to go and get several tests done. So that included blood screening for, you know, STDs and whatnot, as well as some baseline fertility tests. So one was testing your AMH levels, and that essentially means looking at your follicle count and seeing how many follicles, which eventually mature into eggs. It looks to see, you know, what you're looking at. So at the very least, your AMH, you know, might be early indications of PCOS, you know, if it's low, polycystic ovarian syndrome, or if you just have low ovarian reserve. Mm-hmm. So that would be for the indication for the needs for medication throughout the process. So yeah, that's kind of the beginning of how the process started. So I did those medical tests. Another medical test included doing a sonohistogram. And so that is looking at your fallopian tubes and seeing if there are any blockages, because of course that would impede, you know, the egg coming down and all that stuff. So I did all of that and started the process. So I particularly started with IUIs, which is intrauterine insemination. And what that essentially means is taking a catheter, you know, the doctor will insert that and try to place it, the inner end, try to place it as closest to your cervix as possible to kind of replicate natural conception, if you will. And then inject the sperm from the other end. So, yeah, I started with IUIs, but in the back of my mind, I was just like, this one ovary, I feel like I might have to do IVF, which is the next step after IUI. If IUI is not successful, or even if you have certain circumstances where IUI would just be a total waste of money, then, you know, IVF would be the next step.
Did you have to do IVF, or was it successful after?
So, thank God, even though I thought in my mind that given my, you know, one ovary that I would have to do IVF, by my third IUI, I was successful. So I got pregnant on my third IUI.
Okay. How did you go about choosing a donor? Did you have something in mind from beforehand? Did you also get to pick the sex from beforehand? Or that was just a not thing? No, I'm thinking not, because for IVF, I think maybe, but not for... Okay, I'm answering myself. Let me let you talk.
Yeah, you're correct. For IVF, but I think even for IVF, you cannot, because it's just an ethical sort of thing. At least in Canada, I don't believe for IVF you can even pick the sex. But for IUI, yes. With regards to a donor, so the laws in Canada are such that sperm donation cannot be compensated, versus in the US, if a guy decides for whatever reason he wants to donate his sperm, he goes to a clinic or a sperm bank, he will be compensated. I'm not sure what the amount is.
Okay.
So because of that, the US has a proliferation of sperm banks, whereas there are very, very few Canadian sperm banks and Canadian sperm donors. So I sought an American sperm bank because I knew that, of course, more choice. But also they offered more in terms of when you go in, you set up a profile in terms of the actual candidate information. So you would, and of course, these things are paid. At that time, I think there was like a trial period, but I don't know if that exists now. But once that's done, you pay to have continued access. And you go on, and there's an adult picture, in most cases, a baby picture as well of the sperm donor. There is demographic information, age, ethnicity, all that stuff, profession, studies. Some sperm banks actually provide an audio file. So when the donors come in, and, you know, they go through their own tests and everything like that, they actually are interviewed. And so some of them offer the actual audio file of the interview. Mine did not. Mine was just scripted.
Okay.
And what else? They ask questions. But again, some of it is self-reported. So I'm sure people who are familiar with SMCs and sperm donation, there have been reports in the last few years about just some scandalous articles of men donating just willy-nilly, not, you know, some who have mental illnesses and then that's not reported, and, you know, in everything there's, you know, positive and negatives. So you try to keep that in the back of your mind that some information is self-reported in terms of their grandparents, and they would talk about, you know, height and, you know, all these descriptions, etc.
Did you know from beforehand what you wanted, or were you more open to...
I was open because I'm like, okay, in North America, Canada, with my last name, people aren't familiar with Trinidad being multi-ethnic, multicultural. I have a Spanish last name, even though my grandfather is from Venezuela. You know, on my dad's side of the family is mixed up, but I've had instances where people start, they hear me and start blurting out Spanish, and I'm like, yo hablo un poquito, you know? So yeah, I'm like, yeah, you know, I just wanted to, I was open, but also if there was a Black or Latino or Black mixed donor where everything just gelled, my preference would be for that.
Okay.
So in looking even at the donors, like the landscape of donors, you would notice in the single mother by choice communities, there are a lot of discussions about the lack of Black donors.
Mm-hmm.
It is a huge landslide when it comes to other ethnicities and Black donors. Like, there's a very small pool. And I don't know the reasons for that, but the fact is that when you make your, when you go in there and you, you know, if you're, whether you're specifically targeting Black donors or not, or just being open, there are very few to choose from. And so for me, if I recall, there were maybe a handful of Black donors at my particular bank. And again, keeping an open mind, you know, I looked at them and there was one I know that was a front runner for me, but he had sort of like a variation of anemia. I was anemic and I was like, no. Mm-hmm. So certain things, the donors, you know, they test for that come up that, you know, depending on your medical history, you know, would be a big no. And for me, that he was the only one that I would have gone ahead with if not for that particular thing. So then I just honestly, it was the first filter I would say would be pictures. I'm sorry, but even when you're in the world and you are choosing, you know, which guy you like or whatever, there is that superficial lens of, is he, does he look good? For me, another one was height.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a, you know, average to very tall family. And, you know, so on a physical level, those are things that I looked for. But I chose my particular donor because the essay. He is from Dominican Republic. His mom, he's first generation American, but his mom was from migrated from the DR. And he talked about how hard he saw his mom working to make a life for him and his sister in America. And his creative side as well, if I remember, he's he has photography interests and whatnot. So it just all clicked. That really stood out to me, how, the way he talked about his mother. And I liked his baby pictures. He was, you know, a cutie. And his adult pictures, for sure. And, you know, everything checked out medical-wise. Mm-hmm. Another big thing is, when you go onto the profiles, there's one filter for CMV. Now, I can't remember the technical term, but CMV is a type of virus that is basically like when you have cold sores. So the virus that causes like cold sores, yeah, that is CMV. And it's very, very common. However, among, you know, people, however, if that virus is present or active while you're pregnant, it can transfer to the baby and cause issues. So one of the filters on those profiles is, and one of the things that they test you for when you go to the clinics is, are you CMV positive or negative? So if you're CMV negative, your chances, they highly, highly recommend that you get or you find a CMV negative donor. And those donors are very, very slim. So thankfully, I was CMV positive, so that was something that I didn't have to worry about. But yeah, those were the things that I looked for. Another huge thing was anonymity. This is another thing that, a topic that's very, it's a hot button issue in the SMC community, whereby there are some donors who go in and they want to be anonymous. But the years where donor conceived kids have been growing, and there's been more discussions about raising donor conceived kids. One of the big things has been wanting to know that other side of, you know, your family, or wanting to know where your other half of that gene pool comes from. And so a huge consideration is, at the very least, giving your child the opportunity or access to reach out to your donor. So when a guy donates a sperm, he will elect to be an anonymous donor, or be open. They call it open ID. And what that allows is that at the age of 18, if my child or any donor conceived child wants to know more, they can then reach out legally to the sperm clinic, and the sperm clinic can then provide them with the latest record of contact that they have for that donor. But again, 18 years down the road, that might not be current, or I've heard stories where the donor, you know, they made contact and the donor wants nothing, etc. So, but at the very least, it's all about just providing the opportunity for your child, if they do express that interest to learn more, keeping that door open.
So that was important for you?
It was, because I know my child would have questions, and I want to be, it's all about being as open as possible, because educating yourself about this route, one huge thing about donor conceived, and I mean, I think there was a recent thing where Kerry Washington, the actor, she found out that she was donor conceived, and her parents kept it a secret until she was, what, maybe up until like a year ago or 2 years ago. And the only reason why they, you know, divulged that information was because she wanted to go on that, you know, tracing ancestry program, and, you know, told the parents about it. And that's when they opened up. And even then there was some resistance, right? So I think it's really, at least for me, it was really important, because you hear the stories where their parents lie, or the child has absolutely no clue, and going this route is tough enough in terms of its unique challenges. And I just want to make sure that I'm able to arm my child with as much information as possible, so that when she grows up, she can, whether, you know, self-identify with this racial group or that racial group. And, you know, we'll get into this later on, but from a medical health standpoint, God forbid I'm not around. I want her to know. I want her to have access and be able to, you know, have a clue about who, you know, her family tree, what her family tree looks like. So that was another very, very important criteria for me in choosing my donor, him being open ID. And once I selected my donor, you know, you buy your sperm vial and you make the arrangements then for, so there are two different parties, the sperm bank and then the actual fertility clinic. So then you have to pay for the transfer of the sperm vial from the sperm bank to the sperm clinic, and then there are the costs associated with the actual IUI procedure at the clinic.
So as you mentioned that last bit, if you could give us an estimate of what the total cost of everything was. So including what you just talked about, the sperm, the testing, and the actual procedure, because that on the third time it worked. So in general, if you could give an estimate of what you would have paid for this entire process until you got pregnant.
So estimate for my three IUIs Canadian, I would say 3,000 to 4,000 Canadian.
Okay.
The majority of that cost was the actual sperm vial. And it's so funny. Me and some of my friends, some of the moms who've gone down this route, we kind of kid, but not really, of the fact of how expensive it is for that little chinks of sperm. Like when you see, when you're laying on that bed ready to do the IUI and you see that small vial and that small amount of sperm, you're like, what the hell? I think the sperm vial at that time for me cost on average 800 Canadian. Recently, I believe I've seen the cost floating around to like 1500, almost close to, yeah. I mean, costs like everything have skyrocketed. And of course, I think, you know, the whole concept of SMC has been becoming a bit more mainstream as well too. So yeah, it's trending up for sure, but the majority of my cost was the actual sperm vial. And thankfully, the reason why my cost was relatively low compared to like US counterparts is the healthcare system here in Ontario pays for IUIs and IVFs, I think before the age of 43, if I remember correctly. So my costs were essentially hard costs, if you will, for the sperm, for the transfer of the transportation costs to the clinic, for medical, for medicine. So as a result of the tests and whatnot, it was highly recommended that I do progesterone. I take progesterone pills as part of my procedure, as well as what's called letrozole, which essentially just helps your body ovulate and grow eggs. Okay. So it really depends on the person, their medical status, you know, where they are, the US, in the forums, their costs. I was like, thank God I'm here in Canada and I'm paying, and the government is paying for these things. So yeah, that was my total 3,000 to 4,000 Canadian for the three IUIs. And if I decided to do IVF, again, that would have been, the actual procedure would have been covered by the Ontario Health Insurance Plan. However, the medical costs would have been out of pocket. I've had friends who've gone on to IVF, but they've also been able to subsidize their medical costs through their group health insurance plan from work. For example, I know I would have been able to subsidize mine because my group health insurance plan through my employer covers certain drugs, fertility drugs. So
okay. Well, I'm going to switch gears a little bit onto the next thing that you mentioned when I asked what your story is about. You said breast cancer. You didn't say survivor. You said something else.
Mm-hmm. Breast cancer thriver.
Yes, right. So tell us a little bit about that experience. Like, how did you find out that you even, I assume, had a lump or something? How did you find out? And then what was that experience like?
Yeah. So it would have been during my maternity leave. So at the point where my daughter was roughly 6 months, I decided to, in Canada, you have the option of 12 or 18 month mat leave. And I was like, I am taking this 18 month mat leave. And if I need to financially make that work, it meant me packing up all my stuff, putting it in storage and moving back home. That was just a non-negotiable for me because I'm going this route by myself. I thought, just in terms of memory making, just in terms of, you know, what it meant for me and for my parents and for my child, having these memories of being back home was just vital. So 6 months and I went back home and, you know, enjoying myself, enjoying, you know, all the help and everything like that. And this was August of 2019. And towards the end of the year, early 2020, I was like, God, I need to lose this last 10 pounds, you know, these last 10 pregnancy pounds. So I was working out vigorously, very vigorously. And to the point where it seemed as though I woke up one day and kind of looked down. And I was always growing up very top heavy. And I looked down and I'm seeing this bit of lump because, you know, the last bit of my weight I was carrying in my chest. And so I remember calling one of my best friends, and she's an OBGYN back home, and I was telling her about it, and she was like, you know, you should get it checked out. And I was like, oh, well, I plan to go to Canada, make a trip with my daughter early March. And this was, you know, we were also, to give a bit of context, starting to hear like a bit of rumbling about this whole, you know, COVID and all that stuff. I was like, you know, I'm going back to Canada early March. I will, you know, set up an appointment and stuff to see what's going on. And my friend, she was like, Melanie, just pay the money, go to a private clinic back home, and get your mammogram, get your ultrasound. So at least you know what you're working with back home. Because if we a week's time, I planned the trip back to Toronto just for a week. So you know what you're working with, you know, etc. So went to St. Augustine Private Hospital, and I remember again me researching because it was on my mind, like this lump and everything. And I remember reading somewhere they said, oh, if it is fluid-like, if the technician is looking at it and it's fluid-like, then highly likely it's a cyst. Mm-hmm. But if it's solid-like, then it's something suspicious. So it's interesting because when I went there and she was doing a mammogram, I asked her the question and I was like, is it fluid-like? And she was like, no. Go upstairs and get a mammogram done. So that was the ultrasound tech. So that obviously set off alarm bells, right? Got the mammogram. And, you know, the healthcare system is so Trinidad. It's so different from Trinidad because legally in Canada, if you ask that question, a technician would not be able to say a peep. Right? So went upstairs, got it done, and I told my friend, the obstetrician, the gynecologist, about the fact that I was going to get this test done. And I said, I'm going to lie to my mom and say, I'm just going to run errands because I don't want to set her off, get her nervous if I tell her and it ends up being nothing, right? It ends up just being a cyst or nothing to worry about. So when I got the results, I did biology for A's back home, and certain terms, calcification was just like, okay, I knew at that point that this was cancer. And I called her right upstairs in Seneca's private, you know, hospital, and I just bawled and said, I'm coming. She lives like about 10 minutes away from me. And I'm like, I'm coming to you. And thankfully she had the day off from work, and I drove straight to her place. And as I walked in, started bawling again, and she just hugged me. And as a doctor, she's, you know, obviously had experience breaking bad news to her patients and comforting her patients. And I remember her just, the only words that could come out of her mouth was, Mel, I'm so sorry. Mm. I'm so sorry. That's all she could have gotten out of her mouth. And, you know, I stood there for a while crying, and then collected myself and just, you know, went home afterwards. Got home, broke the news for my mom. I said I wanted to be kind of stoic because I knew if I dropped one tear, or she saw, you know, the teardrops just collecting on the sides of my eye, that she would just break out on ball. So I collected myself, went home, broke the news very stoic to my mom, and I just plainly told her I need to go and rest. So I went in and I took a nap, and by the time I got up, my dad was home from work already, and I just remember him saying, we're here for you, we're here for you. And I just kind of got into, immediately got into just this problem solver mode. Like, you know, I called my doctor in Canada and I read out the results. And again, for me, I was like, only God, because I already had this trip to Canada booked.
Yeah.
6 months before, yeah. Right? And so I called my doctor saying, I'm flying in this Friday, and I believe I found out that very Tuesday, I'm flying in this Friday, I need to have an appointment with you this Saturday. I read the results, and I called the airline, I took my daughter off my ticket, because I just didn't know what was going on, what would have happened, yeah. What going up there entailed. And that was the beginning. That was how I found out.
Well, you said around that time was like COVID. So when you did get to Canada, one, how long did what did you do? Did you do chemo, radiation, a mix of both? And then how long did it take? And then what was that like during COVID? I know those are a bunch of questions I lumped in. I feel like they're all related.
Everything kind of moved fast, but in some respects didn't at certain points. And so thankfully my doctor, she lined up everything. So when I arrived the Friday night, I had an appointment with her early Saturday morning. She didn't even, cause she had to do her due diligence, right? But she read everything. I took all the imaging and everything from St. Augustine Private Hospital, all the doctor's notes with me. And she was like, I already set up an appointment with a surgeon on Monday. And so on Monday, the thing is with the lump, it was visible. So there was no question that, it was there, that it exists. And I had the appointment on Monday with the surgeon. He did his physical exam. But he also said, look, you know, it's a very strange time right now. We in the medical community, we've been given direction by the Ontario Medical Association that unless you are on your deathbed, you cannot have surgery. So he said amongst his pool of surgery patients, I'm on the top of the list, given my age, given, you know, the size of my lump and all that stuff. But he's like, I just want to let you know that it is a waiting game. So when I said before that things kind of slowed down a little bit, it was because of these moments where it's like, you're waiting, you don't know what's going on. Whether hospitals are opening up. So I stayed in an Airbnb because, you know, as I mentioned, I packed up all my things in an apartment and everything. And I stayed with, you know, a friend at, you know, certain points as well. And I was just waiting it out. And I left Trinidad on March the 6th. And I want to say maybe it felt like an eternity, but maybe 3 weeks afterwards, I remember getting a call on a Saturday and the surgeons, because I was constantly calling her like every other day, because I'm just like, I've always been very, when it comes to being an advocate for myself, even in Canada, even the fact that we have a free quote unquote healthcare system, I've always been kind of on top of these, tried to be on top of these things. And so she called me on a Saturday and she's like, a spot just opened up for surgery in the hospital this coming Tuesday. You're on the top of our list. Do you want to take it? Yes. Bam. So from Saturday to the Tuesday, it was just, you know, going through the whole logistics of the hospital. I remember having to go there because they didn't accept, they have to do their due diligence. So the fact that I hadn't had a Canadian mammogram and ultrasound, so the day before surgery, I went into the hospital and get that, so that they had that on record for them. they did it. They did a biopsy at that time. And after the surgery, the biopsy results came out that I was stage 2. So there are 4 stages. Mm-hmm. So that was for the pre-biopsy that, I was classified as stage 2. But then after the surgery and when they actually take out the tumor, they'll do another biopsy and reevaluate at that time. And afterwards, it was just a matter of, we don't know, even though with surgery, we don't know with chemotherapy what that's going to look like. So I maybe had my first consult about 3 weeks after my surgery happened, going to the hospital, just being educated about what particular, based on my type of cancer, what particular route or types of medication I would be on, because cancer is different, right? And as well, the stage of cancer that I had or was determined at that time, they make a plan essentially of what types of meds and for how long. So when the doctor dropped the news about the fact that I would have to do chemo for 5 months, I was like, what? Like, I honestly thought in my mind that I would get the surgery, I would have one or two chemo, and bam, I would be on a plane back home, find my way back home some way, somehow, to my child who was a year old at that point. Like, that was my main thing. Like, being done with this as quickly as possible so I can get back home. And when he said 5 months, first gut punch. Then he was like, and you have to do radiation after that second gut punch. Mm. That was going to be another 2 months. So all in all, 7 months, which led it to being me starting chemo in mid-ish April to, extending to the end of the year.
Yeah.
So that was a lot to take in, to handle, knowing that with COVID externally, like, there's, one part of it where it's kind of out of my control, I don't know, but also that physically I would not be able to see my daughter. There was no way physically for me to see her within such a long period of time.
Yeah.
You obviously start questioning, like, God, like, why me? Like, I'm still so young. I made this decision on my own to have my child. And yeah, there's another heart part of her gene pool, but he's not a father in the traditional sense, right? Of the word. And yeah, just all these questions flooding through your mind. And it was tough. It was tough. It was tough not knowing. It was tough not having control. It was tough even just dealing with chemotherapy from a, from a physical standpoint. Right before I started chemotherapy, I stayed with friends of the family. They invited me to stay with them because they were like, girl, you would need as much support as possible. So I stayed with them, and the hospital, thankfully, as well, was like 5 minutes away. So that really benefited me. And for the first 2 months, I was on a routine that entailed me going to the hospital every 2 weeks because the drug that I was taking at that time, they nickname it the Red Devil because it is red. And number two, it wreaks a lot of havoc on your body. a lot of havoc. So it's nicknamed, you know, Red Devil. And, you know, it was just so surreal going into the cancer room, and a lot of services, because it's COVID, were stopped. So, for example, they would have volunteers who would be able to come in and keep you company if you want. Mm-hmm. That was all nixed because of COVID and, you know, contact and everything. And there would be in-person support groups. That was nixed again because of the whole personal contact and COVID concerns about that. So it was pretty isolating. You know, you sat there and I go in, and each and every time that I go in, I'd scan the room. I was the youngest person there. Mm. Everyone, and that was just my experience. Like, I know obviously that there are younger people who are afflicted by cancer, but it was just always something startling to me, to, and a constant reminder that I am the youngest person there. So for the last 3 months for chemotherapy, it was weekly visits. You know, and I had side effects. So the oncologist had to tweak my drugs because of the side effects, some of the side effects that I had, you know, nausea, because I remember my grandmother having, in her 70s or 80s, having cancer. And, you know, you hear the stories, the nausea, the throwing up and all that stuff. I experienced a little bit of that, but they were really intent on minimizing that and the weight loss as much as possible. I mean, I still lost a lot of weight. I lost my hair. There are, if you're really concerned about it, there are ways, methods, mechanisms some people use to try to prevent hair loss. But for me, I was just like, it's hair, it's going to grow back.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel too attached to my hair. So I would say within a month of starting chemotherapy and just, like, my hair was past my shoulders, just seeing, like, literally clumps of hair. I would just slightly pass my hand over my hair, and the hair just falling out in clumps. I was like, no. Again, to me, daily reminder, I don't need this. So I shaved off my head after, you know, a month. So yeah, chemo was rough. Chemo was really rough, especially during COVID times, because certain things, like just going for a walk. I remember I took the chance, and my GP, my general practitioner, she called just to check upon me. And I was like, oh, you know, I went to walk, I just needed it. And she was like, basically, are you crazy? Like, you're immunocompromised and you cannot get COVID. And so I was basically stuck in bed, stuck in a room, stuck in a house.
Yeah.
A lot of people might have been able to go for a walk outside or go grocery shopping. I was literally bound by the interiors of a house.
Yeah.
And so that chemotherapy took me to the beginning of September. And I remember the last chemotherapy, you know, taking a picture, sending it to my family, just being like, this is the last one. And there is a bit of a ceremony once you're finished chemotherapy where in the room there is a bell, and you know, I rung the bell and they took a picture of it. And that was my experience with chemotherapy. And then I had a bit of a break, maybe about a month or so, before I started radiation. And within that month, I had appointments at the radiation department where, again, they would school me about the appointments, what it entails. You know, they then would also have to make measurements. So my radiation appointments entailed, you know, sitting on a bed, and then they would take in the machine or whatever, basically radiate that one, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that one side of your chest. targeting the specific area where the cancer originated. So, you know, there are impacts of that as well, too, from a physical standpoint. The radiation makes you, you know, tired. You're tired from the chemo. You're tired from the radiation. Also, because you're radiating your body, the skin gets affected, you know, with peeling and darkening. So, you know, they recommend certain creams to use on your skin. So I did radiation for about 2 months, and my appointments, if I remember, was every 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that brought me to mid-ish October, because I started in early September, and that was the end. That was the end. And by that time, thankfully, we were able to figure out a way to reunite with my daughter. So I found out through a friend that there was this private charter plane that was flying from Trinidad to Barbados, and then Barbados still had their borders open for commercial flights. So, I mean, we paid the money. So my mom brought my daughter up, because again, she was like maybe a year and a half at that point. She brought her up, and so they both traveled from Barbados then to Toronto. And, you know, they had to go through the quarantining requirements that Canada had rules at that time. But the mere fact that finally, like, my daughter was in Canada. I saw her, and she looked at me like she didn't really recognize me. Of course, during treatment, we, you know, every day WhatsApp chats and all that stuff. But I remember she saw me. She was just clinging to my mom. And she looked at me, and I started crying. And then I sang a song to her that I would always sing during our WhatsApp chats. And she started smiling and warming up. And I think that's what really clicked for her.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's my journey.
Ooh, all right. So, two more questions. Because, wow. Are you in remission now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, I am. I'm in remission, thank God. I, again, advocating for myself, I hounded my oncologist. I'm like, is there anything extra? Because my tumor after the second biopsy, so this would have been actually them having the tumor and, you know, being able to properly assess it, they upgraded me to stage 3 because of the size of it. You know, there's you know, it's a bit limited what you can see, even with all the technology we have. Doing a biopsy when the tumor is still in your body, it's, you know, you could get a more accurate evaluation or diagnosis after the tumor comes out after surgery. So I was upgraded to stage 3. And so with that, the statistics are that you drop from 72% stage 2 survival rate to basically 50% survival rate with stage 3. So basically the flip of a coin. And I was like, no. And so I asked my oncologist, is there anything else? Is there anything else we can do? He told me about a drug trial program where they were testing this experimental drug. It's a randomized test, which means that you might end up getting the placebo. And it turned out that I ended up getting the placebo. However, the benefit of being on the drug is that there's more screening. So because of my age and other factors, I am eligible for high-risk breast screening program here in Ontario, which means that I have yearly mammograms and ultrasounds.
Okay.
Right. Which, again, the government pays for. So the drug trial program was an additional layer where I would see my oncologist. It started off every month, have physical exams. And also with regards to the drug, even though I'm on the placebo, I get an additional injection, if you will, which is a hormone inhibitor. So my tumor was estrogen positive, okay, which means that the amount of estrogen in your body, it just feeds off of that. So it's the injection in combination with the meds basically inhibit or suppress my ovaries from, you know, producing eggs. So lucky me, I am perimenopausal. Am I? Yay. So dealing with that and the drug trial also meant, you know, if after these 5 years they find out, oh, it's confirmed that this drug does in fact, it's proven that it does in fact significantly help women who are diagnosed with, you know, stage 3 or stage 4 breast cancer, then that would be enough evidence then to go to the government and say, you need to include this drug just as a baseline in the care for women with breast cancer. So all those things considered, I was like, look, it's going to be extra time, extra appointments, you know, injection in my stomach, yay, perimenopausal, yay, but, and of course I'm saying this sarcastically, I know people video isn't available, but yeah, there are downsides to it, but the upside of it is increasing my chances of survival.
Yeah, which is most important.
Of survival. And so, yeah, I've just been trying to make sure that I'm on top of all these things, all of my appointments. And every year I have my mammogram and MRI and pray to God that, you know, there's nothing suspicious that comes out of it. And just take it day by day.
Okay, so the last question, because this has been really good. Thanks again for sharing. So the last question is a question that I ask to all of my guests, which is, if anything at all that you want the listeners to take away from this conversation today that you had, anything at all that you want them to walk away with, what would that key message or takeaway be?
So two things. If you are prone, ladies, to having dense breasts, advocate for yourself. And this goes for anything health-wise. Advocate for yourself. And especially in Trinidad, where if you want quality healthcare and you have to pay for it, ask these questions, probe, make sure you're getting the answer to the questions that you want. So I would say if you have either a history of breast cancer in your family or you have dense breasts, start getting those mammograms, I would say in your, you know, 30s, 40s minimum. Also, do your self-exams. I did not do any self-exams. I was not consistent with that. Make sure you do your self-exams. Like, I honestly feel that if I did it, then I would have probably detected the lump earlier on when it was a bit smaller, right? So that will be my first takeaway. And my second takeaway would be there are alternative options to motherhood, different pathways. So I know there's still a bit of headway that needs to be done in terms of normalizing alternative methods, whether it's adoption route or becoming a single mother by choice. But know that if you really want to be a mother and, you know, the traditional sense of how you become a mother with, you know, a male is not available, then, you know, there are other options, you know, do your research and listen to your instinct. That's another thing that I would say, and just go with your gut and explore it. I think you'd be doing a disservice to yourself if you just shut it down and say, and it may be cost prohibitive, but at the very least, look into the option, weigh your pros and cons, and see whether or not, okay, well, you know what? Maybe I might not be able to afford an IUI, but maybe I can go to a fertility clinic back home. I know Barbados Fertility Clinic has a location, an office back home. I don't know if they still do now, but maybe I should just go and get a test for my AMH levels, mm-hmm. or do a sonohistogram to see if there are any blockages. Maybe I need to have a conversation with my doctor about fertility preservation. So just having these conversations with yourself, with your partner, with your parents, but most importantly with yourself early on, and not waiting for Mr. Right, because Mr. Right might come along and he might not want kids for whatever reason. So,
but then again, then he may not be Mr. Right if he don't want the kids and you want them. But yes,
exactly. Find us out too late, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, having those conversations, exploring your options early on would give you ammunition to be like, okay, if scenario one happens, Mr. X is here, then this is how I need to approach the subject. I am 30-something, 20-something years old. If this is something that's meaningful for me, these are conversations that I need to have earlier on. You know, if I don't know what's going to happen to Mr. Right, you know, or whatever your sexual preference is, just, you know, just if children are on, or having children on the horizon for you, just sooner rather than later. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Melanie, so much for coming on this week's episode of Taboo. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to this very informative episode of Taboo. And I will see you guys next week. Bye, guys.